Hi, this is the Moving Toward Inclusive Practice podcast, a production of the Military Families Learning Network's Family Transitions Concentration Area. I'm Bob Birch, and we're continuing our conversation about cultural competence and inclusive practice with Dr. Anne Phibbs. Anne is the founder and president of Strategic Diversity Initiatives and brings over 25 years' experience helping organizations advance their equity, diversity, and inclusion goals. Our conversations with Dr. Phibbs have focused on five spheres of cultural competence: seeking out stories, practicing humility, listening, asking questions, and now we're going to talk about our last sphere in our last episode here, engaging with others. So let's continue this journey together. We're so glad to have you with us, and we are glad to welcome Dr. Anne Phibbs. Welcome, Anne.
Yeah, thanks, Bob.
So we talked about those five spheres, and we've kind of been working through this stuff, I think in somewhat a little bit of a passive way, I think, although in your conversations, we've taken an active look at even things like seeking out stories or listening to. But once we've sought out stories, we're trying to be humble, we're working on all this stuff, we're listening and asking appropriate questions in the appropriate context, it seems like there's something more that we could be doing. And so how do we start engaging people in marginalized communities? And why is that important?
Right. Yeah, because at the end of the day, we can do all the internal work we want to do, and there is really important internal work, but it never works to just go, oh, now I'm just totally woke, I understand all this stuff, but not to engage. The point of engagement is to build relationships, but ultimately also to change things, to make systems work better for marginalized communities and marginalized folks, to make sure that the services that we're offering for people really are effective and that we're offering the right services and offering them in the right way, that we're growing as a provider so that we're learning and getting better. And ultimately, I push a lot of people on moving from kind of allyship or being a champion to being a leader, so that wherever you are listening to this, you can say, how can my my workplace be leading, be a model for how to do this work and engage? And so at some point, you got to kind of step off and, you know, of the like intellectual reading, getting woke, getting, understanding cultural competence boat into the water. It's not a great image, but anyway, you got to swim a little bit. You got to jump in and connect with people. And there's a wonderful book by Kevin Wingy, who started Open Arms, which started as a meal service for people living with HIV and AIDS. And it's in the Whittier neighborhood, I believe, in Minneapolis. They have their own building, and now they deliver food to all sorts of different people living with different health conditions like cancer and other kinds of conditions. And he had a partnership in South Africa with people doing HIV and AIDS work. And he wrote a book called Coming In Right that is about, how do I, as someone with privilege, come into a marginalized community? Because there are ways to come in wrong, to come in assuming that I don't have anything to learn, assuming that my focus, my practice, my ways of doing things, and really my help is better. And even that notion of, this is the kind of the tricky part, then if we're not careful, we can fall into a kind of savior space of my community, my identity, my society, the way I do things is better. It might be how I parent, how I hold down a job, how I live my life, how I partner is somehow more normal or more average or better. Mm-hmm. And how you do it as a marginalized community, maybe because of you live in poverty, you have a different kind of family structure, you're queer, you whatever it is, you don't hold down a full-time job, but you need help, right? And the notion that I'm just here to help you is one there's been a lot of pushback. There's a great quote kind of known in social justice circles from Lila Watson, who was an Aboriginal elder, and she said, if you've come here to help me, then you're wasting our time. But if you've come here because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. And so another person that I highly want to recommend is for this, because it really gets at notions of identity, is Brian Stevenson, Brian with a Y, and he runs the Equal Justice Initiative out of Birmingham, Alabama. I train very frequently with his TED Talk, We Need to Talk About an Injustice, and he has a wonderful book called Just Mercy. And he does a wonderful job of weaving together stories about the criminal justice system and how issues of race, class, and poverty and disability profoundly impact who's in the criminal justice system, who's more likely to, you know, stay, you know, in the criminal justice system, you know, how inequitable it is. But he's really challenging us to think about identity and to say, why are we okay with all of this inequity? And in that way, thinking about, well, I saw him talk at the University of Minnesota, and he was talking about, people ask me all the time, why do I do this work? And he has 18 honorary doctorates. He's African-American, Harvard-educated lawyer. And Archbishop Desmond Tutu refers to him as America's Mandela. He's a truly amazing individual. So I hear him talk, and he's talking about all these people on death row, people who have been incarcerated since they were 13 and they have life sentences, and, you know, people who have just had horrific backgrounds who are in the criminal justice system. And he says, people say to me, you know, why do you do this work? And he said, I do this work because my clients are broken. And then he says, and I do this work because I'm broken, right? So this system breaks everybody. And that is a really different frame than, I just want to go help you. I'm going to work it, you know, I'm going to feed you on, you know, Tuesday night at the soup kitchen. And we need soup kitchens. But when we come in and we just, when it's convenient for us to kind of come in and help in that way, and then step back into our life and go, boy, why can't those people get it together and, you know, pull themselves up by their bootstraps and get a job and, you know, cobble things together and go to college. Well, the system wasn't really designed to have everyone succeed. And so when I come in differently and say, I'm facing my own struggles, but I have a lot of privilege, that means I don't face some of the struggles you do. But what can I learn from you? And how can we do this together? How does my connecting with you and being in relationship with you benefit me? Benefit who I am? Not that I'm doing it just to personally grow, but again, it cuts through that notion of being a savior. Kind of, we're all in this together, and we're all going to use what resources we have. I might have more because I have privilege, but we're, you know, what's ever changed the world is a small group of committed citizens. It's the only thing that ever has. I forget. What's her name? The anthropologist. Is that who that was?
We'll have to look that up.
Yes, we will. Margaret Mead. I think it was Margaret Mead. But at any rate, that's what I think about when I think about engaging. And it's scary work. It's scary to go into community. So I'll share a story. I was the LGBT director, and there's no longer this organization in the Twin Cities, but at one time there was an organization called Black Essence, and it was for African-American LGBT folks. And they had a big event. And this is kind of early in some of my work around my racial identity as a white person. And I just remember I wanted to go to the event. I was an LGBT director. It would have been a good thing for me to go to. I'm white. So I was worried, A, they won't want me there. B, I'll stick out like a sore thumb. And C, I won't know anybody there. And sure enough, I went there. There weren't tons of white people, but there were some. I did know people, and people could not have been more welcoming. And it was just a perfect example of, like, that the goal is not to go into spaces not being nervous, because that's human.
Right.
To be, we have feelings, but it's to push past them and to say, oh, I am nervous, but I need to be there, and I need to go into this. And then to stay, even if, well, not to stay if you're not welcome, but, you know, to not expect that everyone's going to take care of you if you are going into a space and you're one of the only men or one of the only people who's not GLBT or one of the only people who's not disabled or one of the only white people. So, because we tend to have a lot of spaces in communities that there's a lot of segregation. And so I can't tell you how many, you know, wonderful events I've been to talking about gender equity and there's no men in the room. Or incredible, you know, talking about racial equity and there's just not very many white people, or talking about LGBT stuff. And I'm like, why aren't people engaged in this opportunity. And then I hear from people when I'm training, oh, I'm nervous. I think they don't want me there. I don't belong. Well, if it's open, you know, no, you don't want to go to a meeting that's closed. But if it's open, then you do belong. And you might feel uncomfortable. And you're going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're open to it, you're going to learn a lot. And people start to see you there. And that's a big piece of this. It's like, you know, do I get to know communities because I've gone into those communities where I've been welcomed? And suddenly it's like, yeah, maybe I walk into the, you know, American Indian Native powwow and there's not a ton of white people. I don't know. And maybe you walk in and you feel a little bit noticed. Okay, now you know what these folks feel like, right?
Exactly what I was thinking. I was like, now you know what people in marginalized communities feel like when they just try and engage with their government, like go to the city council meeting.
Exactly.
Or, you know, something that we all might think is important or take for granted. So, yeah, I think that's awesome to kind of to have that feeling. The other thing that you mentioned, I think, you know, it's worth talking about a little bit, is just that these spaces exist. We don't, and these efforts exist. I think sometimes we have a tendency as privileged people to think, oh, I see this injustice on the news or on social media. I need to create something. Like, you know what I mean? You know, I need to create an organization or I need to create an educational series or something. I'm thinking here in our cooperative extension and helping professional mindset maybe a little bit. But there's stuff that's already going on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So how do I tap into what communities already exist? Mm-hmm. And one of the exercises I do in one of my workshops is I just ask people to think about their own social identities, which seems like, well, yeah, doesn't everyone do that? Well, maybe not all the time, particularly when we have privilege. We don't have to think about it, right? And so to think, where am I comfortable? And where am I not comfortable? And I always say, it's not a contest. You know, I win. I'm comfortable in 10 spaces because no one's comfortable everywhere. And starting to notice, what are the places that I do go to? And what's it like if I start to move into places where I'm less comfortable and less familiar, but I can learn, you know, how can I be in those communities? And start to realize that many marginalized and oppressed communities have tremendous resources. They're resilient, or they wouldn't be here, right? They're resilient because they haven't been, you know, my goodness, when we go from 15 million Native folks to 5, that's genocide, 2/3, right? In terms of, 15 million to 5 million, that's genocide. And yet we have still, you know, hundreds of nations still struggling in many ways, but also tremendous amounts of, you know, cultural heritage and spirituality and resilience. And so, how to honor that, not appropriate it, not use it for something I need, but to honor it and recognize it. And I think about, so what does it look like to honor that? I was talking to a woman who's Native, and she said, you know, we had done this big event. It, you know, it was like a statewide event, and it was all about kind of Native health. And we had all these people who were not Native, they were like, you know, state leaders, in different areas, show up to kind of, at the beginning, to say, thanks so much for doing this, so glad you did this event, you know, they do that kind of talk, and then she said they all left, right? So none of the state leaders stayed to hear what we had planned. They came to have the moment where they, that kind of lip service. And she said, I felt like I wish they hadn't even come at all, because it was like rubbing salt in a wound. It was like, it's even worse when I feel like, oh, good, you're noticing a community that admittedly doesn't have the numbers, doesn't have the political clout that some other communities do, but is, we're here first, right? That's like, you know, and yet the message is, I have more important things. So when we think, you know, what is one of the most important things we can possibly give anyone is our time. Is our listening, is our effort, is our being present. Not fixing everything, but we certainly can't fix anything until we know what the problem is and recognize it and realize the people living with the problem are the ones who are most likely to know the solution. And it's complicated, right? It's not like everything will be simple and easy and wonderful and flowers, but But if someone were to come to you and say, how are you engaged in our community? Do you know much about us? Have you done any research? Have you paid attention to the history? You know, what are you going to say? And how does that, you know, how does having some familiarity, some knowledge, having done some kind of homework and background, taking some risks, going out into that community, knowing what's important, how is that sends a message like, I care about this.
Right.
And I care about you and who you are.
Yeah. I think that really kind of brings in like all the five spheres that we were talking about,
right,
too, sort of doing the internal work, doing the work on your own. And this is something that came up before, and not expecting it of marginalized,
right,
community or people in marginalized communities, like, well, I'm here, explain,
right,
what it is to be a lesbian mom to me. You,
yeah,
owe it to me somehow.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Teach me.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I really like that. I also am thinking about, we were talking a little bit more about Native communities, and if people haven't gotten the gist, we're in Minnesota recording,
yeah,
this. We're in the upper Midwest, and then I'm from North Dakota. We you know, have quite a few First Nations kind,
yes,
of around here. So we're kind of, but it also is something that is unfamiliar. And this kind of came up, I think, in our conversation in an earlier episode when we talked about transgender, too, is sort of the more distance maybe that we feel, or lack of understanding,
yep,
that we're often kind of struggle to interact and engage in those spaces or with those people.
Right, right. And I often talk about, if we want to think about leadership, taking it to the next level, the leader's the person who's going to be out ahead, thinking a little bit farther out. Maybe they're the person in the back row with the big view of the stage of like what's going on, right? And realizing that I don't have to know someone who's trans, or for that matter LGBTQ, to think about this. So I've said to people, I was training with a sports organization, and this is it's a great inner city sports organization, and they have teams that are male and female, men and women, boys and girls. And I said to someone, when I was training there, have you thought about what's going to happen when you have someone come and say, I'm non-binary, what team should I play on? And this person looked at me and said, is that really a thing? And I said, yeah, it's really a thing. And so the leader's going to say, I don't have to wait till that person walks in the door to start to think about how we might have teams. And I think that these group of folks were starting to think about teams based on athletic ability, as opposed to gender,
right?
Right? So what do those teams look like? And so how can I be prepared for engaging without it having to come from me knowing someone or expecting someone I know to educate me on that? What, you know, there's an awful lot of education that I can do,
right,
on my own to say, okay, you know, to just stop for a minute and say, in my workplace, if someone were to come in the door and say, I'm genderqueer, I'm non-binary, I don't identify as male or female, I use they, them pronouns, ideally I'd like to use a gender neutral or all gender bathroom, right now, somebody listening, how would they feel in your workplace? Have you ever talked about LGBTQ issues? Do you wait until someone comes out? Do you know that the chance that someone's going to come out, if you don't talk about it, is slim? So it's the chicken and the egg. So there's this sense of like, well, we don't need to talk about it because no one's out. And it's like, well, no one will come out until you talk about
right,
it. And the same thing around, I was doing some focus groups at an agency, and it was a primarily white people, and I had some people of color talking about their experiences as people of color in the workplace, and I was really struck by how negative some of their experiences were with nasty words and a sense that they really felt like, I've got to perform 200%. I see people getting promotions that I don't think deserve it, but I see, you know, and they're overwhelmingly white, and just this, right? And so, do we have a way in our workplaces to have those conversations so that we're mitigating some of that stuff and recognizing it, knowing it's probably going to be there, and starting to address it? And so are we having those conversations?
Mm-hmm.
But not having to wait till someone identifies a certain way. So you don't have to wait till you have a certain percentage of people of color to say, because this is what happens with around retention, right? So we get people in the door. A lot of people are trying to hire more people of color, for example, Native people. We get people in the door, but we've done a good job recruiting them. They don't stay because there's all these microaggressions, and nobody who's white, we haven't had any conversations about what racism looks like in the office and microaggressions and implicit bias. And so then it's like, hey, I don't need this job because I'm going to go someplace where they are talking about equity and diversity.
Right.
And so in that way, the engaging is, it's engaging communities. It's also engaging with the people I work with. It's engaging with my clients. And me as a professional, this kind of notion of cultural competence, and particularly as a leader, because I think you can be a leader without the formal position, right? You can be an informal leader. That leader on diversity, equity, and inclusion, on cultural competence, is going to be the person who's always pushing themselves to say, what spaces am I in? What questions am I asking? How well am I listening? Do people trust me? Do people who are marginalized trust me? Are people sharing things with me? Am I someone who gives the message that I care? Whatever my lived experience, I might have been born as a white Minnesotan farm boy in northwestern Minnesota, and I didn't grow up with gay people, and I'm heterosexual, and I'm married, and I'm cisgender, and I don't have a disability, right? I'm Christian. A lot of privilege there. And that person can be a leader and an ally around diversity, equity, and inclusion. All it takes is their the personal values, right? Mm-hmm. So even if I have a lot of privilege, I can say, I want to be that person people trust. I want to be that person that's pushing myself. I want to be a role model for other men, for other white people, for other straight people, to say we can bring this stuff up. So I don't have to have someone trans in the office to say, hey, you know, I was wondering if we could look over our policies and, you know, do we have trans-inclusive health care for our employees? Or, you know, can we think about, is it possible to turn that staff bathroom down on the third floor that locks but is single stall? Can we turn that into an all-gender restroom and then let staff know that it exists? Or, you know, I've worked with people like that when I worked at the U of M. Mm-hmm. Like, you find allies in unlikely places. You build community, and that's how you shift things. Sometimes people think it's all top-down. Yeah, it's great when you get it at the top, but it's also grassroots. It's also bubbles up. And the other connection I want to make is that somebody might say, okay, but, you know, they didn't hire me to be an activist. They didn't hire me to be like a... I'm not talking about being an activist. I'm talking about if these things make your work better. Your work will be better if your relationships with your colleagues are genuine and authentic and there's open talk when microaggressions and implicit bias happen. Your work will be better when, as a provider, a service provider, people trust you, you're authentic, they know that if you do act in a biased way, they can call you on it and you'll get better, that you're someone who's constantly educating yourself and caring. And you're going to be a leader who's, you know, like, you're going to be a leader if you say this, everything that I do around this particular position, my job, is going to be better with this lens, with this diversity, equity, and inclusion lens. And it's not about being a Republican or a Democrat. It's not about being an activist. I had a woman in a workshop say, I didn't come to your workshop because I was convinced you were going to make me be an activist. She literally said this. And I said, oh, if only I had that power, I would change the world. You know, I said, nobody has to walk in the streets, but you're going to do your work better, differently, and you're going to have better relationships and better, I think, better outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think because of the nature of how this podcast has been structured and the fact that we're, you know, talking to you on sort of it's kind of a personal medium. You're probably listening to us right now, you know, with earbuds or, you know, so you're just by yourself, likely. We've kind of been focusing on an individual, but I want to go back to that point. You started with the Margaret Mead quote. I just read something, came across social media the other day about, you know, every change started with a conversation, basically. So to bring it back to kind of engaging with others.
Yes.
In marginalized communities, but just in your workplace, in your friends and family, and finding people who can kind of help you.
And we do this work in community. Like, like, this is not a time to, like, put on a cape and say, I'm just going to save everyone, you know, because I have the best social justice analysis or anything like that. This is about finding allies. I mean, and the other piece is people think this work is, like, dour and serious, and it's like, I never laugh so much as I have with my colleagues who are, you know, we'll come in and we'll say, oh, my gosh, did you read about this judge who, like, you know, told the women in his courtroom that they had to button up their blouses because he was distracted, you know, and you're just like, are you serious? And, you know, and, but we also would talk about scandal and all sorts of other things that we had watched on TV. And in doing that, it helped deal with the kind of sometimes hard stuff of racism and sexism and the stuff that happens. But we pushed each other, you know, to be better. And so it's in that community. And there are always people out there. And they're not always the people you might think. Mm-hmm. So to, you know, you don't have to, if you're a white person, you don't have to go to the queer person or the person of color and say, oh, you know, you can just say, hey, everybody, you know what? On Tuesday at noon, I want to see one of those TED Talks that I heard about in the podcast. And anybody who wants to bring their lunch, come do it. That's how things happen. Mm-hmm. And everyone has the power. You don't have to be the extrovert like me. A big shocker, I am an extrovert. But, you know, you can be an introvert. You can be whatever kind of person you are. You can lead kind of that notion of leading from where you are. But you do it in community and find the other folks. And what really energizes me is everywhere I go, I see that people care deeply about being inclusive. They don't want us to have a society that looks like it did 50 years ago where, you know, people could touch women indiscriminately and there wasn't any just cause, or where, you know, there was no expectation that people of color would end up in leadership positions. Most people don't want that. If there are some who want to hearken back to that, those are not going to be the people that are in your community. But you find the folks who care about talking about this and about building their skills and have conversations, and you just start from where you are. And you'll find probably more people than you think who are willing to do this. That was my experience when I was at the University of Minnesota, that we kept building it and they would come and then they'd want more. And we built successive kind of structures all the way up to a leadership program. It was very exciting.
Well, thank you for helping us build our skills and being with us on our own cultural competence journey. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. You're welcome. You're very welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thank you for listening, everybody. The links to the other podcasts in this series, there are five total, any of the resources that we shared today in today's episode, and a link to more information about cultural competency from Dr. Phibbs and others are on our podcast page. You can find it at militaryfamilieslearningnetwork.org/family-transitions. And you can find more about Anne's work at strategicdi.com. I'm Bob Birch. Thanks again for listening to this whole series, and thank you again, Dr. Phibbs.
Hey, you're very welcome.
This material is based on work supported by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Office of Military Family Readiness Policy, U.S. Department of Defense Award Number 2015-487702-4368.